This is Jamil Jaffer, director of the ACLU's National Security Project. I'm talking with Alex Gibney, who's the writer and director of the documentary film Taxi to the Dark Side. Alex, I wanted to start by saying that I thought you made an extremely powerful film that tells an important story, especially at this particular juncture in American history. And I have a whole lot of questions for you, but let me start by talking about how your film begins with, with this investigation into the homicide of an innocent taxi driver named Dilawar at the Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. You know, along the way in your film, I think that you expose all of the policies that the Bush administration put in place, condoning indefinite detention, condoning torture, condoning abuse. And I think that that, again, is an extremely important story to tell. So I wondered, you know, what precisely made you interested in telling this story and telling it now?
Well, there's two stories going on here. I guess the smaller story, or the human personal story of Dilawar, and then there's the story of the larger story of these policies. I mean, in terms of the larger story, I was approached while I was on a panel for Enron by a very angry attorney, a corporate attorney named Don Glaskoff, was very upset about what had happened at Abu Ghraib, and also was very upset at what he thought was the corruption of the rule of law in this country. And so, you know, he said, would I make a film about torture? I said it was a very important topic. Was there a film to be made? And I thought long and hard about it. I also talked to some other people, Sid Blumenthal, but also my father, who had been an interrogator in World War II, and he just said, look, it's very important you do it. I moved forward to do it, and it was tricky. I was looking for a story that would take us through this very complicated territory, particularly complicated for the novice or the uninitiated, who may have seen a few headlines but doesn't really know how the pieces all fit together. And it did seem to me that the story of Dilawar, which I had seen in a piece that Tim Golden had done for the New York Times, was the story that made sense to me, and it made sense for a couple of reasons. One was his story was the story of a pure innocent, somebody who had been plucked from a village, from a world in which he had never spent a night away from home, literally. He had a small 2-year-old daughter, wife, and in the course of the investigation, it is revealed that indeed is a pure innocent. But also, there are connections made. I mean, the people who interrogate Dilawar at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan are then sent to Abu Ghraib before the Abu Ghraib scandals, and indeed are put in charge of interrogations there. And the passengers in Dilawar's taxi are sent to Guantanamo in a funny way to cover up for the fact that an innocent man had been killed. So it was beginning to, his story, or the ripples from this murder, were beginning to connect all of the pieces of this new policy that was being put together by the Bush administration. But there was another thing in the story that haunted me. In the last paragraph of Tim Golden's piece, he mentions that the interrogators in Bagram pretty much concluded that Dilawar was innocent after day 3 of a 5-day interrogation. But they continued in the interrogations, and also, you know, in his isolation cell with the guards, to torture him until he was dead.
They beat him to death, right?
They beat him to death, in effect. I mean, what was happening was he was being hung. He was being shackled. He was shackled to the ceiling of an isolation cell. That was a method, essentially tacitly approved method in Bagram, of sleep deprivation. That's how they would do it, so that you couldn't really go to sleep, because as soon as you nodded off, you know, the handcuffs would gnaw at your wrists. But he hung like that for some time, and then over time, as a control measure first, and then quickly it got out of hand. These soldiers had learned a control measure called a perennial strike, where they would knee him in the thigh, and they kneed him over and over and over again until his legs, as the coroner said, were pulpified. And ultimately he died from a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot moved into his lungs. So he was mercilessly beaten.
Right.
And all the while, here was this young kid who was hooded, He had asthma, and he was desperately calling out for his mother and his father, and to no avail.
Right. It's an awful, awful story. I think that one of the one of the things that you do really well in the film is to use this specific story as a way to tell a more general story about what's gone on with U.S. policies and the adoption of policies that are completely inconsistent with what I think most Americans want their government's policies to be.
Right.
We've been, as you know, we've been litigating through the Freedom of Information Act an effort to try to get documents from the government about the treatment of prisoners. And one of the sets of documents that we've got that I think are, and this set is probably the most chilling set of documents that I've ever seen, is the set of autopsy reports, including the autopsy report for Dilawar at Bagram Air Force Base. And there's just one after another, a prisoner who died in U.S. custody, died during interrogation from blunt force injuries or from suffocation. And what you do, I think really well in this film, is to take the story of one particular person and really humanize what are otherwise just relatively sterile documents.
And I think, and I'd like to ask you actually a little bit later about some of the documents you're hoping to find. But the other thing I found interesting in telling the story and something that surprised me a little bit was, I felt very strongly about trying to find the people who had interrogated Dilawar and the guards who had not protected him, but guarded him. They were supposed to protect him. And talk to them. And I did manage to find a number of them. And going into it, I was not prepared to view these people with any sympathy whatsoever. You know, I was having read Golden's piece, I was furious.
Mm-hmm.
But I found myself, despite my initial impressions of being rather sympathetic toward these guys who are young, utterly untrained, and who had been put in a position that I don't believe they really wanted to be put in. And over time, things got badly out of hand. And then they were punished. Some of them, at least, were punished. But mysteriously, none of their superiors who had either ordered or condoned their actions were even investigated, much less punished. So I think
most of them have been nominated and, in most cases, confirmed to higher posts.
Correct.
So it's actually quite, quite a contrast between the way that the people who are directly involved and the people who ordered them or tolerated the kinds of abuse that went on were treated. I was actually surprised at how much access you were able to get to the people who guarded, if that's the right word, the prisoners at Bagram. I was surprised so many people were willing to talk to you. Surprised at that?
I was too. And I think over time, I think to some extent they had an axe to grind, because while they felt that they weren't victims, they did feel that they had been scapegoated. So I think there was some motivation for them to talk. But I also think they were deeply haunted by their experience. And when the word got out through the grapevine, that I was willing to listen to their story and listen to the story in some detail, not kind of pick off sound bites, but really try to tell their stories in with some texture and detail, then I think others did come forward, and they were willing to tell me stuff that I was surprised to learn. And one of the terrifying things was that in telling their tales, you realized just how kind of out of control the policy had gotten on a kind of ground level.
Right. It's actually not anomalous, though. I think that if you look at what took place at Guantanamo, for example, we've seen all these documents that discuss the interrogators blasting loud music at prisoners in order essentially to drive them crazy. And the music that they choose seems so bizarre and arbitrary. I mean, I think in one case it was Christina Aguilera that they were
blasting. Christina Aguilera was in the Muhammad Al-Qahtani interrogation logs. It was briefly in the film. I think there was even a report that some of them had used the Barney theme song.
Right. It's just bizarre. I don't know who's picking these things.
But one thing that I found especially disturbing was, in one of these interrogation sessions, and we visualize it in the film along with actual, bits and pieces of the interrogation logs themselves, you know, they come in and present Muhammad al-Qahtani with a birthday cake and sing God Bless America to him. I mean, I'm struggling to understand what effect that was supposed to have and how it was that God Bless America had now become a theme song for torture.
Right, right. It is, you know, to say the least, bizarre, I think. I'm curious to know, are there people whom you wanted to talk to who you didn't talk to or who wouldn't speak to you?
There was one woman in particular, a woman named Carolyn Wood, who was a captain in military intelligence. Her unit was the 519th. And she was the one who was in charge of the interrogators at Bagram. She's not a super high-ranking officer. She's only a captain. But she occupied a kind of pivotal position. And somehow her connection between the people who are operating under her and committing abuses and also the people above would give us some understanding of how these orders were transmitted. Also, Carolyn Wood is the woman who goes to Abu Ghraib. And we know from some of her testimony that people did manage to elicit in relation to Abu Ghraib. She's the one who talks about how some of these policies from Bagram migrate to Iraq. So I tried very hard to talk to her, but she wouldn't talk to me. But one of the other things we discovered, and this was a somewhat surprising discovery for me, was that, you know, it's interesting how some of these policies mutate and migrate like a virus. You know, when people on the military internet discovered that they were using some of these enhanced interrogation techniques at Gitmo, really for the Muhammad al-Qahtani interrogation, even though it was specifically approved for Muhammad al-Qahtani, they felt, well, like, wow, those are some good techniques. Why don't we start using them? Without any kind of a direct order, but nonetheless, it was spreading in a viral way, which I found very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are still a lot of open questions about how that actually took place in practice, how that, which techniques migrated, and, you know, migrated is a kind of passive word.
Right.
And it may be the right word in certain circumstances, or with respect to specific techniques. I think there are other techniques that migration is probably the wrong word. It was more of a kind of exporting.
Right.
It was more of an active thing.
I think
were developed at Guantanamo and then, you know, used intentionally in Afghanistan or in Iraq.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think both things happened, and that's what becomes confusing and also interesting. I mean, you have soldiers on the ground who are operating sometimes in a fog of ambiguity, you know, feeling tremendous pressure to get intelligence, while a lot of the rules that they used to think they lived by have been removed. So what rules are they operating by? That was the big question.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you a question about that fog of ambiguity. You know, I think that there is there's a sense out there, at least some people have it, that that the guards who were abusing prisoners at Abu Ghraib or elsewhere at Bagram or in Guantanamo are being unfairly held responsible for that abuse. And you know, it's clear that there are senior officials who should be held accountable that haven't been held accountable. But I'm curious to know, you know, your view of the extent of the responsibility of these lower-ranking soldiers who have been, in some cases, prosecuted.
Well, I don't think, you know, I don't think we can see them as victims. You know, I think they should have known better. And I think that to some extent, they're in an environment where things keep pushing further and further and further. We know this from some of the medical literature. Alberto Mora mentions it. He calls it forced drift. You know, and military people are very much aware of how this can happen when there are no rules and guidelines. We also know it from things like the Stanford Prison Experiment. So, you know, you got to hold them accountable. But I think the question is, under what kind of, who is creating that environment? And that's the haunting question that I don't think has ever really been properly answered.
Why is it that that question still hasn't been answered? You know, we're more than 3 years since the Abu Ghraib photographs got broadcast to the public, and no senior official has been held accountable in any way.
Because none of the investigations have looked up the chain of command. It's quite clear that the structure of the investigations haven't looked up.
why aren't more Americans upset or outraged?
Well, there's a couple of different questions there. I mean, the question of outrage, I think, is a good one. And why aren't more people outraged? Why are we becoming accepting, in effect, of torture? I don't really understand. I mean, it's true that a lot of people were upset when they saw those images from Abu Ghraib. I think those images had a very searing impact. And I hope, you know, that when people go see Taxi, that some of these images and some of those Abu Ghraib images are there, some that people haven't seen, but also images from Bagram and also images from Guantanamo, will be equally upsetting to people. But I think that the Bush administration did a very clever job of isolating Abu Ghraib, as if to say, you know, it was the few bad apples theory, that it was really only these guys, Animal House on the night shift. And so we'll punish those guys, we'll move on, everything else is fine. But I think, the inquiry that the ACLU has done and the inquiry that a lot of journalists have done, and I think what Taxi does, is to show there was a broad pattern of abuse. It was a systemic problem, and it was a systemic problem that was being given guidance, or at least winking and nodding permission from above.
Right, at the very least tolerating what was going on.
That's right.
Right, and I think that you make this case in the film too, but I think that in many cases it wasn't just tolerating, it was more than that.
But I also think there's a political, you know, there has been a very clever political agenda to use coercive interrogation techniques in a political way to say, look, these are bad people, they're terrorists, we got to get tough, right? And there are some people, I think, who want to kind of look the other way and say, look, I don't want my kids hurt, so whatever they have to do, they have to do. What I don't think people properly understand is how, when you unleash a virus like this, and I do like the virus metaphor, where it spreads, how it takes us, and how we get sicker and sicker and sicker. That's something I don't think many Americans really properly understand.
Alex, just say a little more about how your father reacted when you told him you wanted to make this film.
Well, he was deeply affected. I mean, he knew Donald Rumsfeld somewhat, but more importantly, he had been an interrogator, a naval interrogator, in World War II in the Pacific Theater. He was, in fact, interrogating prisoners on Okinawa, which is one of the bloodiest battles of the war. And it was not unlike an environment, really, at Abu Ghraib, where, you know, the prison was very much in a combat environment. And also the prisoners he was interrogating, you know, were being portrayed in very much the same way that we portray sort of radical Islamists, you know, people who are fanatical, who would fly airplanes on suicide missions, who brutally tortured those in their care. That was the rap, and indeed a fair rap, on the Japanese. But my father, the idea that we would actually use methods that would take us back to the Spanish Inquisition, I'm talking about waterboarding now, or any of these enhanced interrogation methods, was just so abhorrent to him, because he felt not only was it his brief to get information the old-fashioned way, which is to establish a rapport. It's the way, by and large, that the FBI does it, and indeed military interrogators prior to the War on Terror had been trained to do it, but that he felt that fundamentally the way we did it, applying the rule of law, stood for something. It stood for a higher value and a higher ideal. He felt it was what he was fighting for. So to see what was going on in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, and to see with a wink and a nod the condoning of this behavior by superior officers and the civilian leadership, you know, it just sent a chill through him. It made him so furious, so that, you know, not long before he died, he pulled me aside and said, look, you know, get out your video camera, I want to talk to you. And we talked for a long time on video, and I included some of it in the film, both his fury at what was going on and his sense of how the values that he believed that he was defending when he was a soldier had been transgressed.
I think that one of the really encouraging things that's happened over the last few years is that current and former members of the military have come forward,
right,
to talk about how these abusive interrogation methods are undermining morale, how they're ineffective,
that's right,
how they're counterproductive. You know, one of the people you talk to in the film is Alberto Mora, who's the general counsel of the Navy. And I think that he's just an amazing person. He's done so much to fight against the use of these kinds of abusive methods and torture. And I think that that's one of the most powerful interviews that you do.
Well, you know, Alberto, I think he's heroic in this way. He really played an important role working inside and trying to get things turned around. I think he was actually, you know, he initially thought that this must be some kind of mistake, you know, that people just didn't know what was going on. And I think now he understands that actually these things were being condoned at a very high level. But I've talked to a lot of military folks, too, who are deeply offended. I mean, I think, you know, there's these policies, I think, were deeply resented by many in the military because they were undermining fundamental discipline. And indeed, the military rule of law, the military code of, you know, UCMJ, Universal Code of Military Justice. So
right, and they're also making it virtually impossible to prosecute some of the high-level terrorists who actually should be prosecuted.
Even more, on a practical level, you know, this kind of interrogation does not produce good intelligence. It is the rapport-building techniques that have been tried and true tested over the years that produce much more reliable intelligence. Most of these techniques that the Bush administration has introduced into the system are actually techniques that have been used by people like the KGB and the Soviet Union to obtain false confessions. That's their true value. And indeed, you know, as we see in part of the film, it's those false confessions that that misled us in many cases. Some high-value detainees.
You know, when people watch, usually when people see torture on TV or on the screen, it's not in a film like Taxi. It's in a TV show like 24 or something like that. And I'm curious to know whether you think that popular culture is creating a constituency for torture. I mean, do you think that people are more likely to accept this because it's become normalized in popular culture, or do you think that people are able to separate those kinds of TV shows from real life?
I think they are and they aren't. I mean, I'm not a guy in general who believes that, you know, if you see something on TV, you automatically believe it. But I think in the case of a show like 24, it did have a powerful impact because it connected in some kind of primordial way with the fearful psyche of many Americans. You know, the idea is there are bad guys out there, and we need tough guys like Keith Sutherland to attach the electrodes to their testicles in order to protect our children. And it posits some very unrealistic and almost fantastical storylines that people come to believe. And I know that Dean Finnegan from West Point actually went out to the creators of that show.
Right.
To try to get them to stop, because while they were teaching rapport building techniques, because they know them to be, you know, proven and reliable, and because they help maintain discipline, nevertheless, a lot of the kids were saying, "Us, you know, that's old school, pops. You know, we want to do it like Kiefer Sutherland does." It had a palpable effect. So I think when there's an atmosphere of fear, and unscrupulous politicians manipulate that atmosphere of fear, people tend to gravitate towards solutions that seem to the gut to represent a kind of payback, but they're doing more damage to us. I think the one thing that people really haven't undertaken is that, you know, the goal of a terrorist like Osama bin Laden is to get us to undermine our own fundamental principles. That's what terrorism is for. And so people haven't really taken that on board, that in fact, that's how we're losing. Jamil, I want to know from you, what are the documents that you most want to see that you haven't seen?
You know, I think that we have been relatively successful at getting documents from the Defense Department and from the Department of Justice. We've got quite a lot of information from the FBI, for example, about interrogations that took place at Guantanamo. We've got quite a lot of information from the Defense Department about criminal investigations into specific incidents of abuse. There are still some documents from the Justice Department, especially from the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the, you know, the office that put together all of these legal theories that led to the abuse and torture of prisoners. There's still some of those legal memos that are being withheld and we're still fighting about. But I think that the biggest category of documents that that we're missing are the documents from the CIA.
Right.
Because the CIA has been able to operate basically under the radar screen for the last 5 years. And over the last 18 months or so, it's become clear that the CIA is still using what it calls enhanced interrogation methods. Until very recently, at least, it was still waterboarding people. They don't make any apologies about this. They don't claim, as the Defense Department did, that abuse was isolated and aberrational. Instead, they claim that they're doing it as a matter of policy and that this kind of interrogation is something that's been approved at the highest levels. And that, you know, that is obviously a reason to be deeply concerned about what's still going on. So I think that, you know, if there were one set of documents that I could get my hands on, it would be the CIA's documents relating to enhanced interrogation methods. And in particular, I think the Inspector General, the CIA's Inspector General, conducted an investigation in 2004 into the use of those methods. And that's a report, the Inspector General report, is still being withheld by the CIA. So there's a lot out there that we'd like, but I.
And what about videotapes? Have you gone in search of videotapes in light of this, the revelations about the destroyed videotapes of the Abu Zubaydah?
Well, you know, we'd actually gone in search of those videotapes more generally before that, and we had filed a motion with the court in 2004 about videotapes and photographs in the custody of the Defense Department. After we found out that the CIA had destroyed these videotapes of al-Nashiri and Abu Zubaydah, we went back to court and we filed a motion to ask the court to hold the CIA in contempt. And that motion is actually going to be argued tomorrow before the court here in New York. So we're still litigating about the photographs and the videotapes. You mentioned earlier, Alex, that that when the Abu Ghraib photographs came to light, that's when people really started to take this torture stuff seriously.
That's right.
And I think that, you know, for better or worse, people react differently to visual images than they do to the written word.
I think that's true.
And that's part of the reason why we're fighting so aggressively to try to get the photographs that are still being withheld and the videotapes that are still being withheld.
Have you heard that there was any videotaping of the interrogation of Mohammed al-Qahtani?
You know, I don't know. We've been searching our records, especially over the last couple of weeks, to try to sort out whether we have any evidence of that. You know, we do know that some interrogations at Guantanamo were taped. We know, for example, that when foreign governments, foreign intelligence services, wanted to interrogate prisoners at Guantanamo, one of the conditions that the State Department put on the foreign governments was that the interrogations had to be taped. Now, we don't know whether that was a more general rule or whether that was applied only in those specific circumstances.
Right.
But it's a question we'd love to have the answer to. We know, and I think that you know this too, that the immediate reaction force or the emergency reaction force, it's a
right.
force that's gone by different names, which is a force, it's an extraction force that goes into cells at Guantanamo to, quote, pacify prisoners who are acting up. That whenever that force went into cells, those incidents were videotaped. And those are videotapes that we're fighting for as well in court.
Great.
So let me go back to interrogating you now. I was asking you earlier about popular culture and the role of popular culture in
right.
influencing people's views about torture.
Yep.
And I wonder, you know, if you have an answer to this question, why is it that shows like 24 are so popular, but films that confront abuses of power, films, for example, like Rendition, which came out fairly recently, have, in many cases, failed to find the same kind of audience?
It's a good question. I think, in part, because something like 24, which is a pure, raw action movie, also touches on a real... I think it's, first of all, it's a well-made show, and it's designed to be, it moves. It moves very fast, as even the title suggests, the idea that you're always moving against the clock. So it has certain dramatic flair that that I think, a propulsive dramatic player that I think works. But also, it tickles a very dangerous part of the human psyche, which is fear. And the idea is that we're going to get back. There's a kind of a sense of, you know, when you watch Kiefer Sutherland kick the asses of the bad guys, you know, you're not thinking about, you know, is this a good way to interrogate, even though there are discussions about that on the show, and he usually poo-poos the lawyers who are trying to cite due process as he's getting the information that will, you know, help the city be saved. You know, but there's a sense that, no, this is payback time, and I think it goes to our fears, and it affects us on a deep visceral level, that maybe more high-minded programs like or films like Rendition don't.
Right. Towards the beginning of your film, there's a clip of President Bush saying, quote, "One by one, the terrorists are learning the meaning of American justice." And I am wondering whether you have a different view of a quote like that now than you would have had before you made this film.
I certainly do. I mean, American justice, particularly as uttered by George W. Bush, has a rather chilling meaning now. And I think a deeply sardonic one. It's almost like George Orwell, you know, called the Ministry of Torture the Ministry of Love. You know, and that's not the same kind of the American way of justice in its purest form is something my father would have recognized. You know, that's what he was fighting for. But I think, unfortunately, that the Bush administration has taken the American way of justice and turned it into something that used to mean something intensely idealistic to people around the world into something that's now deeply cynical, where might is right.
You know, we're in the middle of an election campaign, obviously, and I wonder how lasting the damage will be that the Bush administration has done to the image of American justice and to the image of the United States more generally. Have you had a chance to think about that?
I have. I think about it a lot. And, you know, in part, one of the reasons I made this film was not to just revel in the past or to wring my hands about stuff that had happened in the recent past, but also to hopefully make a plea for the future. I mean, we're going to have to undo this damage. And I think the only way to really go forward into the future and recapture our standing internationally and indeed hold ourselves high in our own esteem is to be able to reckon with this past in some fundamental way, to really do a proper investigation of the crimes that have been committed in our name.
Alex, thanks again for talking to me and for making such an important film. Taxi to the Dark Side opens in New York and L.A. on January 18th. And in more cities on February 8th, to find out how you can see it, go to www.taxitothedarkside.com. If you want to learn more about torture and the Bush administration's policies, visit www.aclu.org.